Hello everyone. Today we are going to discuss something that is extremely topical and impactful. Ecosystem research finds that almost all large and enterprise organizations in Asia Pacific have an ESG or a sustainability strategy. Some are more mature than others. In Australia, we've seen a sharp increase in interest and intention. So it gives me immense pleasure to invite some guests from down under to discuss their thoughts and sustainability landscape in the country. Welcome so much, Leah, Kai, and Rory.
Thanks so much, Sash, for having me on. So my background, I'm a former climate change negotiator. I've been at six conferences of the parties, starting in Paris, which produced the Paris Agreement Treaty. So very kind of exciting to see the evolution in this space. I also have a bit of experience in West Africa, supporting city-level climate action planning. And after kind of being inspired by the momentum in companies worldwide setting net zero, I joined Terrascope as head of sustainability. And we are an end-to-end decarbonization SaaS platform.
Cool. Kai?
All right, thanks, Ash. So my name is Kai Lincoln. I'm the Vice President of Global Sustainability for Seco Logistics. Seco is a multinational freight forwarding company based out of Chicago in the U.S. We've got about 140 offices in 40 countries. My background is in logistics and supply chain, and for better or worse, that's all I've really done for about 25 years. And my shift to sustainability happened about a year ago, and fortunately, the stars aligned through a combination of timing, necessity, and passion, and saw me exit my previous role with Seco and getting them to offer me this new role to help establish Seco's sustainability framework and get the ball rolling on a number of initiatives.
Thanks, Dash, and hello, everyone. So, I guess for me, I'm a lifelong pursuer of curiosity is basically the way I'd describe it. So I started my career as an architect, working in North America, Europe, and wound up down here in Australia. Spent the first half of my career pursuing that career. And then about 7 years ago, moved across into what we call client side, into a property company called Frasers Property Limited. They're an SGX listed company with approximately 40 plus billion AUM globally. So they work across, what we call, multi-asset property portfolio. So they've got, logistics centers, they've got retail, commercial, hospitality, and residential. They both have a large existing property platform, if you will, and quite a number of developments globally as well.
Now, the three of you actually have experiences and represent three very different industries, and it would be good to get the different perspectives from each of these industries, especially when it comes to supply chains and scope 3 emissions, because not only does it account for about 80% of the emissions of large enterprises, sustainability officers also find it notoriously difficult to, combat and achieve the goals. Shall we start with the logistics industry first, Kai? Where is the industry at, and where do you see it headed?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I would describe it with three main points. So the first one is around big ambitions, and that's probably across the board with every industry, obviously. But what we do are mainly scope three emissions. Unless you are an ocean freight carrier that owns your own vessels or an airline that owns your own planes, most of us are simply trying to manage the movement of these goods, and we're trying to do it through, we're trying to manage our reductions through influence. So big ambitions is one thing. To be able to make wholesale change simply through influencing is a challenge. There's obviously an issue with emerging innovations and issues of scale. So there's some biofuels on the market and alternative energy sources on the market for moving vessels, moving vehicles, but to do that at scale is challenging. So there's not enough of the biofuels. There's not the infrastructure required, especially in Australia, to electrify delivery fleets for the distances that vehicles often have to travel. So that's a challenge. And then it's trying to create that collective effort. And this is a good thing, but it is a challenge. Trying to create a collective effort of what can we do right now while science and innovation are doing their thing and trying to catch up. So the things that actually are within our direct control are the things that we can do in partnership with these vessel owners or airplane owners or truck owners to get them to move faster or, you know, in that direction. I think that's the challenge of supply chain is we know it's a huge emitter. We know it's a huge challenge. We don't have the answer yet.
No, and that's precisely why we're having this conversation here today, right? So, you know, come to some kind of commonality on how it can be handled. Leah, what about the agriculture industry? You've been working a lot with the agriculture industry. So any insights from there?
If we look at the latest guidance from the Science Based Targets Initiative, which is kind of the gold standard for how you set your targets with a carbon budget aligned with 1.5 and kind of measure progress against those targets. There's new guidance on the forestry, land use and agriculture sector, which is called FLAG. And this is really important because we have this moonshot challenge of getting to half emissions by 2030 in the context of high economic growth. And the agricultural sector is responsible for a third of global emissions. So big piece of the global supply chain puzzle. So in this FLAG guidance from the Science Based Targets Initiative, companies now need to set two separate targets. So they need to separate out their energy and industrial emissions from their forestry and land use emissions and set two different targets for that. This opportunity is because removals in the land use sector through, for example, regenerative agriculture, which sequesters carbon in the soil, more trees on farm, actually counts as removals to those targets, but you can't count it to industrial targets. So there's this new guidance with this opportunity to start looking at removals within the value chain. And there's also a kind of zero deforestation by 2025 embedded in that FLAG target. What's also kind of very significant is that companies with 20% of their emissions coming from FLAG across scope 1, 2, and 3 must set a FLAG target according to the SBTI guidance. And actually consumers or downstream actors who might not think of themselves as FLAG companies are going to find out because that 20% threshold across the supply chain is pretty low. So it means a lot of companies will be applied. So for example, apparel companies may be sourcing leather, cotton, and other natural fibers. And so upstream, that could hit the 20% threshold and set FLAG targets. Also construction and real estate. So kind of talking about Rory's sector. So timber-based building products could bring companies over that threshold. So forestry and land use is applying to much more companies. So does it apply to you? And if so, what should the upstream suppliers be doing to reduce those emissions in line with this very significant source of global emissions? And in Australia, there's less than, of the companies that have set science-based targets, only half have actually, well, they've committed, half have actually now validated and set them. So there's really a lot of work to do in the forestry and land use sector around measuring and planning out that reduction journey.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, Leah, when you were talking, I was thinking about this, like we think about heavy emitters, you know, being manufacturing and telecom, data centers and all of that. But we forget that primary industries actually impact pretty much every industry out there, right? I mean, and it came across when you were responding to that question. Rory, Leah mentioned real estate. Could you take us a little deeper into it?
Yeah, I don't think we can move towards some of our global goals if real estate isn't on the journey as well, because if agriculture is sitting there at 35, I think we've probably got a worse rep at about 40% of global emissions being associated with real estate and property. But what's interesting is when you start to, you know, deep dive down into that and where the emissions start to lie, and a huge percentage sits in scope 3. I've seen, emissions inventories from property companies where your scope 3 emissions is sitting at 97% of the overall emissions. So I think for property and real estate companies, and of course that changes on your activities, you know, if you're more leaning towards, you know, development and construction of new buildings versus owning existing buildings, you know, that will shift across the scopes. But realistically, I think it's very hard to be credible in this space with net zero targets if you don't have a plan for how you're going to identify, assess, and manage your scope 3 footprint. Now, it's easy to say that, but it's incredibly hard to do because you have to look at where those emissions then are coming from under your scope 3. So if you take your average developer, you know, the emissions could start to break down with, you know, 25, 30% being associated with the construction of new buildings. Now, how you go about quantifying that in itself can become challenging because if you do not have the actual emissions data of every bit, you know, every brick, every piece of mortar going into your building, then you're going to have to rely on proxy sources, which could be spend data, which may not be relevant to your direct activity, but in the absence of your own data, you will have to rely on this. So you can start to see the challenge then that that poses, even mature companies who've started to understand that. Now, that's, as I say, maybe 25%. You know, another 60 to 70% of your emissions will be associated with the operation of those buildings. Now, if you're developing those buildings to retain them, then obviously you're going to be incentivized to make them as energy efficient as possible, to minimize their ongoing emissions and that kind of thing. But if you're building those buildings to sell them, then that's a whole different equation. And then you're trying to figure out, well, what's the value uplift in creating a more energy efficient building or home, if it's residential, that you're going to sell to someone else? But you still have to quantify the emissions associated with the life of that building under your scope 3 as well. And then there's other things around, you know, land clearing or the demolition end of life. So you can start to see, even just for something as, you know, that might appear simple on the outside, how challenging it can be. And then you've got other factors as well. So you've got the decarbonization of the energy grid. So if we look at, you know, global grids and we start to see them move to more renewable sources, what you'll start to see is, you know, emissions associated with operating the buildings will go down, but the emissions then associated with building these buildings will become a bigger piece of the pie. But I guess the good news is that, you know, property companies, particularly in mature markets like, you know, Europe, North America, parts of APAC, they're onto this. So while there's big plays around removing gas infrastructure from buildings, electrifying everything, on-site, off-site renewables, you're starting to see, I guess, the early seeds now of collaboration between supply and demand side in the supply chain itself. And I know a number of geographies whereby, you know, suppliers and contractors, builders, developers, they're starting to work together so the right signals can be sent to the supply chain so the low emissions materials can be produced at, you know, greater quantities with greater cost efficiencies that can help accelerate, you know, that pathway to zero.
When we talk to sustainability officers, you know, and anybody who's responsible, who has got a sustainability mandate within an organization, we hear of micro level challenges as well. And you've been in the hot seat, Kai and Rory. So could you tell us some of the challenges that sustainability officers actually, you know, face within an organization in kind of making this all happen?
Sure, I'm happy to kick off there. So a good friend of mine who's been in this space, you know, probably even longer than me, you know, he reckons that his superpower is being able to read minds because he feels that internally he has to be able to read his stakeholders' minds to be able to make any progress. I probably don't possess that power, but I think one thing that's really important in these kind of roles is the ability to connect dots. We have to be able to speak multiple languages so that we can take something that can be quite intangible, but make it relevant and material to those who are in, you know, CFO roles, they're in procurement roles, they're in legal and risk roles, because for action to happen, it has to become real, it has to become tangible. So what I find, first of all, is that, you know, when you can get to a place where the conversation starts with a question of value, i.e. what's the value of doing that? What's the value of that investment versus the almost dumbed down version is what's the cost? I think if you can start with value and you can articulate that in a way that aligns with your stakeholders or resonates with your stakeholders, then you at least have commonality to go forward. But before you can do that, you almost have to get into their shoes and you have to spend time understanding, you know, their challenges and what it is they're trying to do. And I know one of my own personal examples was when I moved from being an architect and on the consulting side into client side, one of the teams I spent the most amount of time with in the first year or so was just the marketing team, just understanding what it is that they're trying to connect to with our customers and how they might position something like sustainability. And I found that, you know, by completely reframing the conversation of sustainability around quality, still talking about the same things around energy efficiency and longevity and all these kind of things that are synonymous with sustainability, but simply reframing it around quality resonated more so with our customers at the time. This was 7 years ago, which then got the buy-in from the marketing team and a whole host of other internal teams who could rally around this. So I think, you know, for anyone in these kind of roles or looking to be involved in these roles, it is understanding your key stakeholders' drivers and trying to align, you know, what it is you're doing with their value.
I like that concept of, you know, a value-based discussion. Guy, you're all ready to answer.
Yeah, so spot on, firstly. So I was given a presentation last October in the US, and I knew that within the audience there were some climate skeptics, we'll just call them that. And so, you know, in terms of aligning with stakeholders, I think that's an incredibly valid point. And the point that I made to them on that, in terms of, you know, speaking their language, was, look, there's a number of reasons why you can get on the train and go through this journey with us, and hopefully it's because you care. Some might be because you're a hiker and you're super passionate about this, whatever the reason being. And for a lot of these guys, the reason, maybe it's just commercial. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of the clients that the logistics industry serves these days also have their own targets and their own reduction goals. And if you're not on board with this program, then you're going to start missing out on opportunities. And the message that I gave in terms of trying to be relevant to those stakeholders was, if the only reason that you're getting on board with sustainability for now is because you don't want to miss out on opportunities and bids and RFPs, I'm actually fine with that right now, because you still got to get on board. Once you're on the plane or the train with us or the bus, whatever vehicle that you want to be on metaphorically, then we can bring you along for the ride, and hopefully you start to get there and you start to see that we're actually trying to do good things. So I love that analogy. Sorry for the tangent. I think the other challenges, I mentioned the lack of available alternatives, that is an issue in supply chain right now. And that impacts, we're talking about scope 3 for, you know, the real estate industry, the agriculture industry. We just, across the board on these big emission topics, really don't have immediately available, scalable alternatives. So that's a problem. Within our industry, you know, we service consumable goods largely, disposable consumable goods in a lot of cases. And the shift over the last 50 years basically removed localized manufacturing and has transferred manufacturing to low-cost countries in mass. While that's been good for the price tag of goods on shelves, it does now mean that we are forced to ship the majority of things we're buying across the world to get it to the shelf that it needs to be on. So that is a big challenge. And I know that COVID, probably more than sustainability, drove some conversations and action around, you know, near sourcing and local manufacturing, things like that. So I think, fortunately, there's been a number of factors that have appeared recently where companies are looking at the way that their supply chain and their manufacturing within their supply chain operates, and that could have changed in the future. But, you know, the biggest challenge that we are seeing globally within logistics is this conflict of the materialistic world and the consumer-based world that we live in, and the constant demand for growth versus, do we really need it? Do we need to be manufacturing these things? And so,
Leah, and I'm going to start with you, you know, especially from your policymaking hat.
So on the collective action piece, really important. And I think, well, first of all, I think the go-to response was looking at carbon credits and offsetting in companies broadly. And there's now a shift in that industry from offsetting emissions and kind of externalizing that to actually exactly what Kai is talking about in terms of, I'm in the logistics and I need sustainable fuel to power my logistics. And so actually that dollar spend really needs to go into the reduction solutions. And how do we make some of these system-wide transformations? I think I like to think about it with different circles. So the first circle is really the internal circle. So our clients in Terrascope are multinational corporations with global offices and complicated kind of organizational charts. And so getting your own house in order. So moving from just data collection to actually internal organization, alignment and empowerment. The next circle is that supply chain, it's upstream and downstream supply chain. You know, 97% of emissions coming from the supply chain is tremendous. And so there have been some, well, having the data to now engage the suppliers is a really powerful factor, going and saying, you know, 20% of my emissions are coming from you. I've seen these trends in the sector, and this is what I'm looking at as a business. So having that data-empowered engagement. And then finally, that other outer concentric circle is investors, regulators, consumers. So the investors are actually pricing in climate transition risk. Some investors have three strikes policy and you're out, maybe more expensive capital in the future. So the regulators are already looking at legislation. It's on the horizon. It's definitely coming. And consumers like your kids, Sash, you know, they're who are looking at greenwashing and demanding at transparency and will drive from kind of bottom system wide up.
You know, Leah just mentioned, you know, all the activity, you know, with investors, with regulators, you know, compulsory disclosure, three strikes, you're out, you know, assets now be having their climate risk exposure being valued in, not just how exposed are you to climate change, but how exposed are you to not decarbonizing as well. So you're pretty much asleep at the wheel, I think, if you don't see all these signals happening around you. And yes, there's a number of carrots and, you know, jump on the electric bus if you can grab a carrot. But if you miss the bus, there's going to be a stick coming for you. But I think, you know, that's what's happening external. Now, none of us operate externally. We're all in organizations. You know, we're all looking to create change there. So I think that's where the energy is still required. So again, that comes back to how do you harness the energy internally? How do you harness your marketing teams? How do you harness your operational staff and your leadership? How do you take these initiatives? And as I said earlier, how do you ensure that it becomes a holistic, you know, endeavor internally? So that means that, you know, the person leading investment has to understand what ESG or sustainability or carbon or whatever means to them when they make the call. It means that, you know, the team leading risk understand, you know, what are the risks, both direct and indirect, you know, that are happening as a result of internal operations and sustainability and external factors. And all this information then, you know, through good governance has to flow through the correct internal bodies using the right systems so that, you know, the C-suite, the board have oversight and can perform their fiduciary duty. So these are all the little bits and pieces that need to start coming together for this, for the collective action to happen internally as well. But I think what you're seeing is you're starting to see that maturity. You know, one thing I find very interesting is, you know, this concept of a sustainability professional. You know, I think I personally don't think they exist as something that's standalone, because some of the best sustainability professionals I've seen, they're accountants, they're lawyers, you know, they're marketers, they're people who have actually come from a discipline and either through curiosity or passion or actually just making commercial sense, they have become the champions and they're the ones now that are helping to accelerate this holistic change.
Data forms a huge part of this whole, you know, achievement of sustainability ambitions. And Rory said something about proxy data. Yeah, like not having all the real data that you need and sometimes the need for proxy data. Now, let's be realistic, you know, it's not possible. Like today, if you want all the data, you may not have access to that, right? But you need sustainability action today. The urgency is from day one, right? So how do we make the proxy data useful?
When it comes to kind of digging into the data a little bit, I've got a lot of great case studies and things that we're doing. One is so oftentimes purchase goods and services in scope 3 is a major source of emissions. And for food and beverage companies, that comes in kind of a product. So for example, a can of tuna, and we're able to use kind of data analytics to almost like explode that product out into its different components. Using kind of standardized different recipes, calculating the emissions of each component, packaging that back up and getting a much more accurate estimate for that emissions factor. And actually, we looked at 700 SKUs and did a comparison of what the actual recipe looked like and found a 92% accuracy. of that footprint, and then we were able to scale that up across 5,000 SKUs. And so this is an example of, you know, going out and doing that manually is going to take a lot of time, and you can use and leverage data science to get really good and accurate results. And then the next step is future looking. So taking that kind of data and saying, what if we were to substitute, you know, aluminium in the can for a more either lower emission source or even an alternative ingredient, and or what if, you know, that was powered through renewable energy? So you can really create future-looking simulations that help to then either make decisions in the company's own operations or then engage suppliers and say, this is what it is. I think there's a huge business opportunity for any companies in this space to bring the transparency out and say, this is my emissions factor for this product. Because what platforms like ours can do is then surface the lower emissions factor and present that in the dashboard as alternatives. And, you know, those are going to be the winners.
We're almost till the end of the time, but I would like to ask you one question to all our three panelists, and the good and the bad both. Where do you think Australia is headed?
I think the good thing is that there's enough of the ASX listed companies and the companies that really drive the economy of Australia that are already treating this as a priority. And hopefully, regardless of who's in government at any one time, we won't lose the momentum that has started at the moment. We've got some major infrastructure challenges in Australia around alternative fuels, even things as simple as electric charging stations. We're a big country. If, you know, as I explained to my colleagues in the US, we are physically the size of the continental US with the population of Southern California. And that makes it really hard to logistically roll out things like electric charging stations for range of electric vehicles and things like that. So we've got challenges on the infrastructure side, but hopefully the government has now caught up to corporate Australia. Now we can, back to the collective action conversation, we can work collectively across government and business to move things forward. That's my take on it.
Cool. Rory?
I think it's always, you know, a bit of a risk to ask an Irishman to comment on another country's politics, but maybe after what we kind of, you know, lovingly refer to as the decade of inaction here in Australia, where to the credit of industry, I think actually industry stepped up in the void of that momentum. And you can see that through the, you know, the global real estate sustainability benchmarks and how Australian listed and based entities often outscore their peers from Europe and North America and that kind of thing. So I think it's fantastic now to actually see the political environment come a bit more into line with industry itself. Because you need that happening as well. So I think that's a real positive. I think you're seeing, you know, certainly in our industry, you're seeing construction codes tighten. You're seeing a bit of a shift as well in what, you know, customers, mums, dads, first home buyers, what they expect. We used to have this whole thing about no one's going to buy a home that doesn't have gas cooking. I'd be really nervous if I was working for a gas company right now, to be honest with you, with what I see happening in the residential and commercial sector. But I think on the flip side, you know, we're still looking in very siloed and isolated lenses. We're looking at carbon quite often purely through the lens of carbon emissions, whereas we know there's a direct link between biodiversity loss and climate change and carbon emissions as well. And I don't think we understand that fully. And particularly when we're living in a country that has the world's greatest loss of biodiversity, we don't know what opportunities we're missing. And we probably don't know what harm we might be doing as well through some good intentions. So I think I wouldn't call it the bad, but I think that's probably the next step on a maturity journey we need to go, is piecing together some really complex things together in a much more complex system.
All right. Leah?
Yeah, kind of looking globally at the good, the bad, and the ugly, I think the small island states have at kind of returning full circle have really been pushing this loss and damage concept at the the UN level, which that the consequences of inaction result in very dramatic costs. And that's why, you know, there's been this big focus on the international opinion to the International Court of Justice and loss and damage and who's responsible. So the cost of inaction are tremendous, and the international community is putting a lot of pressure on countries. And so it's good to see the progress in Australia. It's coming quite late though, right? Lagging behind other jurisdictions like the EU in particular. So I think the safeguards mechanism, looking at kind of top-down carbon budgeting and moving towards the emissions trading scheme, pricing carbon type approach, is now following in those footsteps. So that we can see where the regulations are heading. There's also the Treasury's paper out on mandatory climate disclosures for large companies, which is very likely to include scope 3. So that will affect kind of cross supply chains. And then just Australia is really not working in a bubble, right? 72% of the local agricultural produce is actually shipped to Japan, the EU and USA. So a lot of those deforestation free, linking the biodiversity, is going to affect companies working and doing business in Australia, no matter where you are. So the tide is coming. I think we can expect regulations that pricing carbon much more, that have much greater transparency, more focus on scope 3 and supply chain to get to that net zero journey and kind of align with a lot of those global trends.
There's some wonderful insights from all three of you where Australia stands today. This is one of the topics that I could keep talking about, but unfortunately we've run out of time today. Leah, Rory and Kai, thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing your experiences and insights, and I'm sure we'll speak again soon.
Thank you.